This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Simon Connolly.
And I'm Morgan Marion.
We're doing something a little different this episode. Voting for Bug of the Year 2024 has just opened. Morgan and I are super excited, and we're going to talk about all of the candidates that you need to know. You can go to the Bug of the Year website to cast your vote. We'll link it in the description of this episode.
So today we're talking about Bug of the Year. Can you tell me a bit more about Bug of the Year?
So Bug of the Year is, as you might have guessed, an annual contest where we put it to the public vote to decide who is New Zealand's best bug, at least for that year. Think Bird of the Year, but better, because there's bugs and bugs are better than birds. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably think that, right? We pick 20 or so really cool bug candidates. We put them out to public vote. Last year you got 3 votes. We're hoping you get 3 votes again this year. And that is kind of all tallied together, and we find out who is New Zealand's favorite bug. And it's to kind of raise awareness of these species, bring things into the public eye, maybe shed a new light on things that people don't necessarily like. Sandfly was an entry last year, so it's all kind of weird and wonderful things that get thrown around.
We do love controversial nominees, I think.
So who was our champion last year, Morgan?
Well, last year, after a fierce competition, it was the native bee, Leiopoctus fulvescens, which was crowned the Naro Huruhuru.
Yeah, definitely a really cool one and a really interesting one. I think it was really helped along by a cute factor, but it's definitely a cool critter nonetheless.
I think people just love bees lots. But it was really, really nice to be able to teach people about our native bees, which are so different from the common honeybees that everybody knows about. So that's definitely been an uptick and a really positive side of that.
Yeah. And that was the first ever Bug of the Year competition, and we're now screaming our way into the second Bug of the Year competition. But there's no bees on this list, so shall we get straight on into the contenders for 2024?
Let's begin.
Hey!
So who's your first nominee on your list?
So the first nominee on my list is the catapult spider, a very, very famous little arachnid.
Oh, yes. I've heard a lot about this little one.
Yeah. They're a really, like, just a really beautiful little widow spider. And yes, they are related to, like, the famous black widows. But that kind of sells them a bit short. They're not really all that dangerous in New Zealand. I mean, don't get bitten by one, definitely. But you're having a really unlucky day if you do. I think, yeah, no one has actually died from a bite of one here since 1901. So it's
pretty good.
Yeah,
that's
it's a really rare thing to get bitten by one, because you mainly find them out on, like, sand dunes and stuff like that in amongst the grasses, I think. And there's pretty readily available anti-venom if you do get bitten by one. They're a super cool little critter. They're actually endangered, which a lot of people don't know. And we think that they're part of that is because they're interbreeding with a introduced Australian widow spider, which is like diluting their gene pool. It's really weird and really cool.
Amazing. That sounds very cool and, like, interesting work, which you're probably very familiar with.
I'm a little bit familiar with it. I catch up with those people now and then.
Well, yeah. I see your little cute spider who has not killed anyone, and I raise you
since 1901.
I raise you a fellow arachnid that sucks on blood, and it's the Tuatara tick.
Tuatara, as in the lizard?
As in the lizard, as in our really famous reptile. So this tick, as the name suggests, parasitizes Tuatara. They are only found on a few islands that Tuatara live on, so they're pretty rare, even rarer than Tuatara. And not only that, but research has actually shown that they're quite distinct from other tick species. So they're rare and very special.
That kind of makes them like the Tuatara itself, right? Because the Tuatara looks like a lizard, but isn't actually a lizard. And these things, I guess they are ticks, but different from all the other ticks.
Yeah, they've got their own special group.
That's really cool.
Very separate. And they feed on their blood, so they're completely specialized on them. However, even though they feed on their blood, they can actually survive without their host for up to a year.
Wow.
So,
did they do much damage to the Tuatara, do you know?
No, not as far as I know. They don't really seem to aggregate in huge numbers.
Okay, so you just get a Tuatara that's got a couple of ticks on it, not causing it too much trouble.
And actually, it's been a thing now where when they do relocations of Tuatara, back in the day, they would used to, you know, send them all off completely clean and pristine and ready to mingle. But now we are being a bit more careful and trying to move them along with their fellow travelers.
So we probably actually did a lot of damage to them inadvertently by just cleaning them off those Tuatara back in the day.
Well, we were trying to help the Tuatara, not the tick.
Yeah, that's conservation in a nutshell. Get rid of these nasty invertebrates so we can concentrate on the charismatic vertebrates. That's such a cool thing to think about, though, of that like concentric levels of endangeredness. Like, you have the Tuatara, which are already really, really rare and really, really endangered, and then you have this other whole other level of these ticks that are only found on some Tuatara.
Oh, they're pretty cool. They sound awesome. I'd love to see one in real life. I've seen Tuatara, but never with any ticks on them, so. And they're one of our nominees.
So, what do you know about the New Zealand giant centipede?
That they're quite cool, but they're really huge, and they do look a bit scary, to be honest.
Wow, that's coming from bug lover Morgan.
No, I know, and absolutely. But this is a personal history for me, because centipedes growing up on tropical islands in New Caledonia used to have huge, colorful ones that we were always told don't, because they had quite painful bites. And so I remember coming across those. The New Zealand one is slightly nicer, I believe.
Well, the first thing I've got in my notes of this guy is painful bite, so I'm not sure, honestly. Yeah. I think you're having an unlucky day if you get bitten by one, but yeah, they can bite you if they want to, which they probably don't.
The ones that I've seen in the wild seem like scaredy cats. Every time, you know, you like flip a log or something, they just kind of run away from you.
And yeah, you say they're big. To be precise about how big they are, they're 20 centimeters long, so that's like 2/3 of a foot for our imperial listeners.
That's like the length of my forearm. Jeez.
How short are your forearms? That can't be right.
No, wait, no. I have a ruler. I will measure my forearm.
This is great audio content. Morgan's measuring her arm. I can see it on my screen.
My forearm measures 27 centimeters from like the top of my wrist to the tip of my elbow. So I'm not far off.
Well, there you are. There you are, folks. The fun facts you never knew that you needed to know. A New Zealand giant centipede is 7 centimeters shorter than Morgan's forearm. Top level audio content.
Yeah, I don't know what you'll do with this information, but it's out there now.
Tell me about the Cromwell Schaefer beetle, Morgan.
Ooh, chunky, flightless beetle. Does that sound cool to you?
It sounds really cool.
It's only found in one spot in central Otago near, you guessed it, Cromwell.
Imaginatively named, I like that.
The adults are a pale reddish brown, and they live in shallow sand dunes. They emerge at night and during the spring and summer just to eat plants and lichen. They seem pretty cool.
There's a cool story about these guys, isn't there? About, like, we built a fence around them or something?
Yeah, so the species is currently restricted to a 81-hectare nature reserve, making them quite rare and endangered. But when the nature reserve was created in 1983... at that time, it was the world's first and only reserve created specifically for an invertebrate.
Which is such a cool, like, concept. And I've seen pictures of this place, and it just looks like some, like, moss with a fence around it. It's the one place in the world where you can find Cromwell Schaefer beetle, I guess.
Yeah, they have found it in a couple of other places of populations over the years, like before the reserve was established. But every single time some sort of development would happen, a dam or some houses got built and the populations there got decimated. So I think that's what led to the reserve being like, right, we need to do something now. There is actually an annual survey of the Cromwell Schaefer beetle that happens by Doc and Ag Research, where one day a year they all go out to count how many beetles are in the nature reserve.
I'm imagining like the world's biggest emu parade. They're just wandering around all their heads down looking for beetles.
It pretty much looks like that. Exactly like that. It sounds like a great day for me, to be honest.
Oh, definitely. And what do they actually like do in the reserve? How do you conserve a beetle? What do they actually need to do for it?
Well, just make sure it's got the proper habitat and that doesn't get destroyed, and try to keep out predators. I think one of their main predators at the moment seems to be hedgehogs. Yeah, if they get in, they'll just munch away. And then another predator somehow is the Australian redback spider.
That's a callback. We talked about that one already. That's what's breeding with the caterpillar and kind of diluting its gene pool.
Yeah, yeah. So they're also eating Cromwell chafer beetles. They're kind of these poor little beetles, and they're flightless as well, so they're not going anywhere.
Well, you said people keep putting in dams and developments. When that happens, they're a bit screwed if they're a little beetle that can crawl around at 1 mile an hour or something.
Yeah, so it's being hammered on all sides, really.
Mm. And I guess one of the things that we're learning here is that the invasive Australian redbacks are bad.
Who would have thought? Going from one little beetle to another weird... Well, no, I love them. Tell me about the New Zealand glowworm, Simon.
Well, I think we all love glowworms, but they are definitely weird. This is not the last thing on this list that is terribly named, but glowworms are absolutely terribly named.
Why do you say that?
Well, because they're not actually worms. They're the larvae of flies. They're the young of flies, which makes them maggots. So they're not worms, they're the maggots of flies that glow. Mm-hmm. So the glow part is right, I guess.
They do glow.
Yeah. And the reason they glow and you'll be able to hear about this in all the tourist traps that we have to show off our glow worms, is that they hang these little like silk threads out to catch their prey, which you can see out and about if you have glow worms near you. You just put a torch on them, you can see all these little like silk threads hanging down, sort of like a spider's web, but they just make kind of almost like a chandelier of silk. It's very, very cool little structure.
I think that is just, they're so, so cool. Like, they're just literally going fishing for their prey.
Yeah, and then it's just like the deep sea anglerfish. Like, they put the little light out and the very stupid and impressionable insects fly straight towards the light and straight into the trap.
One hell of a strategy, to be honest. I think that's what I would want to be doing, is just hanging out, glowing from my butt, having, you know, little sticky lines, fishing lines, and then just reel it in once you've caught something.
And you say, like, that's what you'd want to do, because that is actually what they spend most of their lives, like, doing. Despite the glowworm stage being just their juvenile stage, that's how they actually spend most of their lives. They only live a handful of days as an adult when they actually turn into proper, like, flies. They look a little bit like a mosquito.
So really, the adult stage is just for mating?
Yeah, and in fact, I was hearing about glowworm mating just today as an astounding coincidence. The females, like, emerge, and you definitely want to be a female glowworm. They get the much better deal, because the female glowworm emerges from her, like, pupae, and then she just hangs out, just sits exactly in the same spot, and the males have to go and kind of hunt for females to mate with. And no one's really sure, because the adults are really difficult to study, but we think that the females only mate once. They can mate with a male. The male presumably goes off and tries to find other females to mate with, which is presumably very difficult if you're in a cave that's covered in glowing lights that will kill you if you go too near them. And
that's true. I wonder if they've ever caught, like, an adult of their own species.
They must do. And apparently the females glow out of their abdomens to attract males, but presumably the flies can tell the difference.
Wow.
Yeah. The females lay eggs, like, exactly where they were just sitting. So they lay their eggs in the same place that they hatched from, which is kind of cute. They get, like, a little family home going. And then, yeah, the females fly off as well. And we think that they, like, will go out and lay a couple more eggs elsewhere, but we're not really sure. I was just listening to a talk today about someone who I work with who's researching them. It's really, really cool stuff. And, like, for such an iconic species, we know so little about them as adults.
Well, it just shows you that there's still so much research we need to do about so many of these critters. No matter how iconic they are, there's always more to find out.
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of one of the reasons that Bug of the Year exists, right? It's a lot like Bird of the Year, but, you know, better because it's bugs. every year the winner of Bird of the Year gets a lot of attention and a lot of like push for research and stuff, and we want that to happen with these bugs too.
Absolutely, yeah. So the public knows more and we can get more money for them.
Hell yeah. But also just to, you know, spread the word. Cool bugs. We love cool bugs. We love two things. We love cool bugs and we love money to spend on finding out more about cool bugs.
We're doing a podcast, aren't we? So
yeah, I'm a PhD student and a podcaster. My love of money has not taken me very far.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's next on our list, Morgan?
What is next is the amazing, the beautiful black cockroach hunter wasp.
Is this so badly named or is this brilliantly named?
It's appropriately named. It's accurate. These are incredible insects. These ferocious hunters, the females, they go out and go and catch native cockroaches. So of the species Scylla tobolata, the female wasps are ferocious hunters and they go out and find these cockroaches and they paralyze them. So they don't kill them, just paralyze. They drag them back to their nest and then they stuff them into a cell. They lay one of their eggs on top, close the cell, and there we go. Dinner's ready for the babies when they come out.
An utterly terrifying way to die if you're a cockroach.
Absolutely. Do you want to know another cool fact?
I mean, go for it, but I'm not sure I can beat that.
Well, apparently each cell normally has 3 cockroaches. So do they go out and count like 1, 2, 3, lay an egg, seal it up, and wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Crazy.
That is absolutely insane. I mean, so many wasps are famous for doing this, that like paralysis and then laying eggs inside their prey.
Yeah, so they're pretty, pretty cool. They nest in simple nests, usually high up on riverbanks and sand, and it's usually quite high up because so it's out of the way of a flood if that were to happen. So,
and when you say nest, they're not social wasps like the ones that build big aggressive hives, right?
No, they're solitary. They kind of just go around, do their work, and, you know.
So they're friendly wasps, unless you're a cockroach, I guess.
Yeah, the one kind of caveat to all of this, as a female myself, is that I read about how males emerge before females, and as is common sometimes in the animal insect world, they'll wait around the where the females are going to emerge. And so they'll wait around, all excited. This is what the researcher wrote. Very excited, so they're kind of running up and down the banks. And then once the females start to emerge, they'll mate with her immediately. Sometimes multiple males will try to get it on with one female, and they'll kind of roll around in this ball of multiple males and just one female stuck in the middle. And yeah, that usually lasts for about 40 to 50 seconds, and then that's that.
Yeah, that's very common among bees and wasps, but can't be pleasant for those females. Yeah. Can you really blame them for wanting to take out some of that rage on some poor innocent cockroaches afterwards?
It all makes sense. It's the circle of life, really.
You can explain that to the cockroaches, I'm sure.
Well, let's go on to something maybe a little bit nicer.
Yeah, we've got the forest ringlet butterfly. Not many native butterflies in New Zealand, but this is one of the real nice ones. Like a lot of stuff on this list, the population is declining, and we're not really sure why. This would be a great one for someone to throw some research money at. Like a lot of things, we think it's due to kind of habitat loss and introduced European and Chinese wasps. And it's also, speaking of things that are kind of weird and not like a lot of other stuff out there, it's the only species in its genus, which means that there's no other like close relatives of it in existence anywhere that we know of.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. New Zealand, the land of the weird and unique and completely alone, really.
Oh, that, you just made that sad.
They're not the colour that people kind of expect when you say a butterfly.
How would you describe them, Morgan? You're better at describing things like this than I am.
They're kind of, you know, they're a brown butterfly, but they do have some patterning of a bit of yellow banding on the edges of the wing. But really, their most striking part is the underneath of the wing, where they've got a banding of brown and white in some spots as well. So they are quite pretty.
Subdued and tasteful, you might say.
Oh, that's a good description. Subdued and tasteful.
Well, let's move on to the next item on our list, which is, I believe, the minute grasshopper.
Yes, minute grasshopper, Cygaus minutus. So they're a species of short-horned grasshopper. They're one of the smallest and rarest species of grasshopper that we have here in New Zealand. And they're found only in the Mackenzie district of the South Island. They're quite small and very cute. They measure about 1.6 centimeters, so they're very small, with the females being much larger than the males. There's two color morphs found in central Otago. So the most common color is a dull brown that's got kind of patterning of other colors of brown on it. And that's to match the local rock that they're found on. And then the other color morph, they've gone the complete opposite. It's a bright yellow green that is meant to match some of the lichen that's found in their environment.
So if people are looking for a bug that they can get behind, maybe this can be like the Otago representative.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we do have a few other kind of...
I mean, yeah, we got stuff that's like from around that area. I'm not sure we have anything else that's exclusively like Otago.
No. They're very much found in that area.
Mm.
They're just so cute. They're so small and cute. And on the right background, they're very well camouflaged. So they're doing it right.
Yeah. I've seen people showing pictures of them on rocks in talks, and it's like, here is a picture of some rocks.
Yeah, when you research them, one of the things that always comes up is how they like basking in the sun, and I can totally empathize with that. I also love basking in the sun, so we're on the same page here.
So if you were to be an insect, you would be some kind of like cross between a grasshopper and a glowworm. Is this what we're getting at here?
I think so, yeah. Okay. I think so. We just need to be in a nice area, not moving too much and hiding away from the world. I'm there for it.
Definitely. Well, next up, I have an interesting one, which is I reckon it's an animal that most people won't have heard of, named after a person that almost everyone has heard of.
Ooh, now you've piqued the interest.
So this is the Hobbit Psyllid, which is Scylla Frodo-Bagginsy. It got a few headlines back in the day when the entomologist that named it after, of course, Frodo Baggins, the most famous hobbit who has ever lived.
Of course.
I read a couple of the articles and they're all like, because they're written by some of the overseas like news outlets, and it's like, it's a Middle Earth icon because it's found in the South Island, which is where Middle Earth is. Everybody knows that.
But you know what? It's such a good strategy from the researcher.
Definitely. And it's a cool name as well. And it is, in fact, compared to other psyllids, and I'll get to what a psyllid is in a moment, because I didn't know until I properly looked into it. I kind of knew in the back of my head, but I definitely had to remind myself. Compared to other psyllids, it is really small, or it's at least a bit small. It's like a hobbit.
So in comparison, that psyllid standing next to the other psyllids, who are Gandalf, that's the hobbit one?
Yeah, exactly.
Makes total sense.
So yeah, they're like, this is a small psyllid found in New Zealand, the South Island, Middle Earth. It must be a hobbit.
All right. Well, tell me what a psyllid is now, I think.
So psyllids are part of the Hemiptera, which are the, like, quote-unquote true bugs. So if a pedantic scientist tells you that this such and such insect is or isn't a bug, that's what they mean. And they get a bad rap because they're generally referred to as plant lice.
Oh.
They're a bit kind of like an aphid or a shield bug. They got their like the stabbing mouth part, which they use to suck the juices out of plants. So gardeners and farmers tend not to like them. That's the main reason you'll hear about a psyllid, unless it's the Hobbit psyllid, I guess.
Yeah, we've gone from a very cute name to a very mean name almost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think Hobbit psyllid is much better than plant louse.
Hobbit psyllid, to me, I'm imagining this little psyllid living in his little hole, you know, with his little and everything. That's the picture I'm getting.
And he's got a sign on his gate that says, no admittance except on plant business.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're bringing me the juices of a plant, then yeah. You've got, you know.
Well, do we have one more to round us out for this week, Morgan?
Yes. We have the biggest moth in the country. The coolest moth in the country, and it is the Porphyry moth. This moth, you will have seen it. It's probably hit you in the head, to be honest.
if it was, you'd remember it.
I have actually hit somebody in the head with a Porphyry moth. I've threw myself. But that's a story for a different day, totally unrelated. So these moths can grow up to a wingspan of about 15 centimeters.
Wow.
Pretty big, and they're mostly all greens, very cool patternings of green, but you can get some weird color forms. I've seen a yellow one, I've seen a red one, and I've seen a blue one. So
yeah, and awesome. We were saying before how we're not like the land of butterflies, but Pereire moth are a moth that's so like beautiful that they basically count as a butterfly, right?
Well, yeah, they're iconic. They're so cool. And actually, a lot of people kind of know a lot about the adults and how they only live for a few days. You know, their main goal in life as an adult is to just find a mate and lay some eggs.
A lot like the glowworms.
A lot like the glowworms. A lot like many insects, to be honest.
Yeah.
But did you know that as a caterpillar, they've got two very different feeding phases?
No, I didn't know that.
So when they hatch out of their egg and they're a little tiny caterpillar on the forest floor, their main source of food at this point is fungi, so mushrooms, and that's what they're going to be eating. And then they reach a point where they switch, and that's when they'll go and eat their plant host, and that's what then they start burrowing into that tree trunk. And that's when they'll kind of spend the rest of their caterpillar stage, and then eventually emerge as the adult that we know.
That is super cool.
Pretty hardcore life cycle, to be honest.
So that is the first half of the contenders for Bug of the Year 2024.
Is it? Yeah. Already? Not bad. Not bad.
We're going to go over the remaining half in our next episode. Yeah, I think there's a reminder of this in the end card. But in the meantime, you can have a look at all the contenders on the Bug of the Year website and have a look at who might be your favorite. See what you think. Get involved.
Who's your favorite out of the ones that we've
What are the ones we've just talked about? I mean, I'll always have a special place in my heart for glowworms. I also can't go past the spider, you know. Caterpillar, really cool. Given those two were my first instinct, I'd say either the glowworm or the caterpillar spider.
Mm-hmm.
If I think about it too long, it gets too hard.
I am torn between the tuatara tick and black cockroach hunter wasp.
Both strong picks. In our next episode, we'll take you through the remaining hot contenders for Bug of the Year, including a very exciting spider, a flea that isn't a flea, and some returning competitors from last year. Don't forget to vote for your favourite bugs using the link in the description. Who will be your 2024 pick? You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Merrion. You can find us at ScienceBugPod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by Free FM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favourite podcasting app. Catch you next time.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.